Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right?
Tons of popcorn there. Yeah. And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
We're downtown Toronto headquarters, 1979's Video Nasty, Don't Go Near the Park.
Now, is it 1979 or is it 1982? It was released in 1982.
Well, I think there's lots of, well, by the looks of the finished product, there seems to have been lots of production errors that maybe lent itself to lots of continuity.
Well, no.
Issues.
I think if you watch this movie, it's obviously they don't care about production, they don't care about continuity. They don't care about quality in any way, shape, or form. I think what happened was this movie was just so low budget and so inconsequential to whomever was distributing it that they just let it languish on the shelves. And then this is all conjecture on my part, and then come 82 with the slasher boom, they thought, hey, let's put this out there. And they did, and what we have is this extremely bizarre movie that I'm not going to lie to you. I mean, as I was watching this thing, I kind of hated you. Why the fuck are you making me watch this? This is literally
making
one of the worst
you watch it. This is like Mystery Science Theater or something.
Well, no, honestly, yeah. I would have loved to riff on this movie, man, because I was riffing in my head. Like, this is one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And
well, it was compared to
comprehension.
It was compared to Manos in some reviewers'
Manos,
eyes.
At least Manos, there's things going for
Is there an at least Manos
yes.
in this podcast? Oh my God.
You got Torgo, you got the soundtrack, which I actually have on vinyl. You have stuff going for it. The only thing this movie has going for it, really, is the fact that it's one of the earliest appearances of Linnea Quigley, who, of course, ended up becoming one of the preeminent scream queens.
Yeah, made an early appearance. Impaled on antlers in Silent Night, Deadly Night. And
Dancing in the Tombstone of the Living Dead.
Night of the Demons. You could go on and on. She's got a lengthy, storied B-movie career.
But this is not one that I think that she'll be proud to have on her resume. Now, you also mentioned this was a Video Nasty, and we've talked about Video Nasties before, and I want to talk to you more about Video Nasties maybe later today or in a future podcast.
Yeah.
And for the life of me, I don't know why this was a Video Nasty. Is it because it involves some sort of cannibalism? I mean, it could not have been more unconvincing.
Yeah, silly putty, H.G. Lewis kind of asinine special effects.
Yeah, I mean, plasticine chest being ripped open, rubber body parts being taken out, covered in some sort of Karo syrup being eaten. I mean, this was not a movie that was going to somehow destroy the minds of the impressionable young. I mean, if anything, it would destroy their minds just by its sheer inanity. But this is, and then another thing with this movie, too, that sort of puts it in the pantheon, is it's another don't movie. It's another admonition movie. Mm-hmm. So we have another Video Nasty, which is a god-awful movie that we talked about on the podcast. Don't go into the woods again.
Yeah, don't go into the
phone.
Don't go in the basement, all this stuff. Yeah.
So we got Video Nasty. We got the don'ts. We got a movie that is so fucking incomprehensible. Honestly, it's like, you talk a lot of times about tone and the movie not knowing what it wants to be. And this is a movie that had a tone that was all over the map, had no clue what it wanted to be. And I'm going to sort of explain where I was when I watched this movie and why I sort of hated you. But before I do that, I actually want to ask you, why did you pick this movie? I ask you this a lot, but I'm really curious.
Because I was perusing the bowels of YouTube and found it.
You always say the bowels. What's the bowels of YouTube? I don't
know, the deep, dark basement.
Because all I did was type in the Google, title. Yeah. There was no real...
Of Google headquarters or whoever mm-hmm. bought YouTube. And it came with a lot of, obviously lots of baggage and unfavorable comparisons to Manos, Hands of Fate. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, for the sake of completeness, and when I first started watching it, I gave it 5 minutes before I suggested, perhaps erroneously as you're saying now, that it's something we should watch when it was 12,000 years ago, throwback atavistic caveman setting, and I thought this is going to be really fucking nutty. And I thought is this a slasher? Why are these cavemen here? And mm-hmm. then I thought, okay, let's go through with this.
Well, that's the whole thing. I'm going to be honest with you again. I mean, full honesty right now. When I decided to sit down and watch this movie, this was the day of the eclipse.
Yeah.
I was at home. I had nothing to do. I decided to get a little inebriated.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say upon what substance.
Yeah.
But it's a substance that makes you sometimes question things, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And here I am, going just by the title alone. Don't go near the park. And I'm thinking, this has got to be a slasher. So,
yeah, with some guy lurking in the bushes with a knife, brandishing like a giallo style, kills people in the park. Mm.
And here I am in my inebriated state, and I see this crawl about garbage about eternal youth and cannibals needing to rejuvenate bodies.
And this is based on a true story. Yeah, which, when you go back 12,000 years, and, obviously yeah, 12, it's based years, on a true and story. Thinking, yeah.
And I'm explaining a slasher, and I see this ridiculous cave. It sort of reminded me of, like, I don't know, it was like this weird fantasy sci-fi, almost like Luigi Cozzi, like Hercules, like with this woman sitting there with this god-awful makeup pontificating about some, I don't even know what, just blathering on and on.
Some gobbledygook about extending one's life through something or other.
And in my state that I was in, I question, am I watching the right movie?
Yeah.
Is this it? I did not, and then it went a little bit further. Okay, this is the right movie, but where the hell is this going? And where it went to was someplace weird, and then it went someplace else weird, and then it barely held together. It was barely cohesive.
Well, the positive spin on that is that it's episodic. Now, the negative would be totally incoherent because it goes through these. It's an act in three parts. You've got cavemen, and then you've got a love story, and then a coming of age with kids in a sort of quasi group home. So it's divided into these three seemingly, you know, disconnected different parts. That's why, like, I was questioning the production process, because I thought with a gonzo plot like this, they had to have done some sort of post-production tinkering with the product to make it somewhat coherent, because there's lengthy exposition. Which I think was filmed.
There was
quite a bit afterward. There was lots of day for night continuity.
There was a lot of lengthy padding. There was just scenes that went on and on. I didn't need to see baboons' butts for 10 minutes in a zoo. It was interminable in a lot of ways. I mean, you mentioned before we started hitting record here, H.G. Lewis. Yes, there is an H.G. Lewis quality to this. Although this makes H.G. Lewis look like
Orson Welles. Exactly.
There's some Edwardian aspects with a lot of padding, a lot of stock footage, and of course the incomprehensibility, the disregard for any sort of believability when it came to acting, when it came to special effects, when it came to anything. But again, those movies, for some, you know, the H.G. Lewis films, the Ed Wood films, there was some sort of connective thread that had them, you know, going from point A to point B to point C. This movie was just zigzagging all over the place.
Yeah.
And like I said before, at the very beginning, I didn't realize that I was watching the right movie, because I'm in this state of mind going, this can't be correct. And then I started hating you because I was actively disliking the movie. But then I started to sort of go with it, and I started to enjoy it. And then it wore off, and I was stone cold sober, and then I started hating it even more.
Well, I guess in previous podcast, we sort of give a little sketch of the plot. I'm going to try and go over the entire plot to the best of my understanding, because I was texting you as I was watching, saying, and this is a frequent occurrence on the show, I have a lot of questions for you that I hope you're able to elucidate for me, because, yeah, this is a little bit rough going. From mm-hmm. the best of my knowledge, we're sent back into the past, into the let's say...
Well, yeah, you do that sometimes. You say, I might need you to explain this to me.
And you, like, said the same thing.
I said, so, actually, this time around, I think I might need you to explain this one to me, because I am lost. But
so we go back to maybe the Stone Age. So I don't know how far back that is, geological time, but whatever. 12,000 years ago, and there's some woman with a curse, and she puts it on these two cave people.
On her children, I believe.
I think so, and they're... brother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
Their names are Gar, because when you're in a caveman times, apparently your language isn't developed enough to develop more than one syllable.
Exactly.
So that, and the sister, his name escapes me, they have a curse placed on them.
Petronella.
They're cursed to live...
for an eternity.
For an eternity, but their years that they live are equivalent to 10 years.
10 years aging age. For every year of life.
Of life, yeah. So and in order to curtail this, they need to drink human blood.
Right, and preferably a virgin or something. Mm-hmm. Or that was, but ultimately, they have to make some sort of human sacrifice at some point in the future, and it has to be some sort of seed of one of them. I think it was Gar's seed.
Oh, okay, so right, they explicitly said it had to be their seed. That makes a lot more sense, because I was wondering, why didn't they just feast on virgins? Instead of, okay, so you picked up
well,
on
they
the
wanted fact. To eventually... lift the burden of this curse. And the thing, too, is, I mean, they did explain midway through the movie what they did to get this curse.
Yeah, yeah.
To have this calamity befall upon them, but it wasn't explained in the beginning. So you're just like, why? What's the significance? Yeah. I don't know. And, yeah.
So presumably, well, their spawn would count as both... virgin. Well, maybe you get double points because you get your spawn and it's a virgin. Mm-hmm. Or she, is in the case of their... kid.
Right. So by ultimately giving birth to a certain... then there's some gobbledygook about, like, the planets aligning or something.
Yeah,
like that.
And some astrological mumbo-jumbo.
And then
mumbo
you gotta
jumbo.
Do this and that, yeah, and yeah. This will be lifted, and everyone will live happily ever after. And I had done some cursory IMDb, you know, look at the synopsis and whatnot, think, okay, cannibal movie, well, okay. And I'm thinking cannibals, well, then this is also video nasty, so hey, man. I'm going to get some Ferox going, man. Some Holocaust.
Yeah,
some,
yeah.
You know, some
Dr. Butcher. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Exactly. And then I see the first instance of cannibalism. And this is, and the movie kept flashing forward. It's like every scene was a time jump.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. First we go from 12,000 years ago to 16 years ago. And then every scene seems to be like another 5 years past. And we see Gar and his Petrella. I mean, they're living now in some unnamed city. Wherever they could shoot without permits.
Yeah, exactly.
There was a lot of guerrilla-style filming yeah. there. And Petronella is this weird woman that lives in a forest and is prone to wearing, even though when she doesn't consume human flesh, her face becomes ragged and old.
It's yeah, and then consuming. She Benjamin Buttons herself when she eats human yeah. flesh. She her very unconvincingly, because they had no budget, instead of showing her face reverse aging, they show the back of her head going from very unconvincing slapdash gray dye to also wholly unconvincing slapdash blonde hair. So when but she feeds, she reverse
even,
ages.
Even though her goal is to reverse age and to look youthful, when she wants to conceal her appearance, she wears an old lady mask.
Yeah. Huh.
Another inexplicable
thing.
Now, we see a kid, and he's fishing. The kid's fishing. Gar goes and says, how's the fishing? The kid goes, not too good. Next thing you know, he's taking out a cord of some sort, strangles the kid, drags him away, rips open his shirt, or her shirt. It was hard to even tell.
Yeah, yeah. Feasts on the entrails.
Yeah, but again, like ripping apart a very obvious plasticine torso and taking out these novelty shop parts and whatnot. And again, we're coming to Caro syrup, and I'm just thinking to myself, this is completely ineffectual. I mean, if you thought that the gore in Blood Feast looked unconvincing, that was the height of cinema verite compared to this. And then this ludicrous plot continues.
Yeah, well, I mean, Linnea Quigley, she plays a landlady who's renting out this pathetic room, and her first appearance is Gar walks in on her in the shower And he says, you know, apologize and said, oh, I'm just trying to rent and the Linnea room. I'm not a psycho or anything.
Linnea set a template right then and there in her very first role.
Oh, in the buff.
In the buff.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. At least silhouetted behind, you know, and behind the shower. And then she comes out and you get to see her in her full gorgeous all together. And yeah, again, like of all the people to whom one would rent a room, I would say last on the list is a guy who lets himself into your home and walks in on you in the shower. But sure enough,
hey, he was not bashful because then
he gave
a tour of the home and the room. She didn't bother to get dressed. She was wearing a towel.
Yeah.
She had the other towel wrapped around her head, all like a turban.
Yeah.
So he decides to take the room. And
before you know it,
time jump.
Yeah, and they're a couple. Married. Yeah, they're a couple. So obviously they hit it off, and she's pregnant. He guides her through the delivery process, like some, what do you call him? The name escapes me. A doula. Yeah,
it's a doula.
Yeah, someone who helps the birthing process.
Abdullah the Butcher.
D-O-U-L-A. And all of a sudden, he's got his entire being consumed by creating, I guess, a progeny in whom he can invest and ultimately feed. And
you say feed? Yes, we have children. We feed them.
He wants to feed on. Yes. Yeah, and the name, well, I was going to say, you've been to Australia. This is not to be confused with Bondi Beach.
Ooh.
They name the child Bondi.
Bondi.
And why? Like, what significance
there was
to
a
that?
Reason.
Oh, do
it,
tell.
It was
do
asked.
Tell.
It was asked, why did you choose the name Bondi? And Gar said, because this child
is our bond.
Is our bond. It will bond us in some sort of form or fashion. So the kid's name is Bondi. And the next scene, the kid is 16.
Yeah, and he buys her this amulet that's made out of gold. And this big to-do is made of it because the wife says, whoa, you're spending all this time with Bondi and you don't care about me. It's all Bondi, 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 Bondi. And she, you know, vamooses. And so what you're left is now you have a completely different setup with, I don't know, is this supposed to be building up tension to see if this young woman will escape being fed upon by these sibling time travelers
because
or whatever the hell they are?
At this point, Bondi is stifling under the protective
auspices.
The protective auspices of her father, and he wants to keep her in a certain way, form, and fashion.
Well, I guess to keep her a virgin.
Yeah, he chastises her for many things, and she ends up running away. And at this point, Bondi and Gar have very little interaction with the rest of the movie, because then we skip to another element, and this is sort of like the coming of age where she escapes to a farmhouse,
a de facto group home. It's a ranch.
Yeah.
It's a group home because you have runaways. It's loosely a group
two.
Home. You have runaways who hang out at a ranch.
There are two people there.
And I think this subplot is entirely devised, I think, in post-production to make sense of this, because I don't know why this would have been created.
I completely disagree with you. I think this was all...
This was all part of this guy's grand vision.
Yeah.
All right.
This was a 19-year-old, his name escapes me now, who wrote and directed this movie.
19.
Yep. And I believe there was nothing, once again, there was no consideration at all for continuity, for plot, for development. It was just throw it up on screen, see what happens. There was nothing. There was no tinkering with this whatsoever.
Oh, okay, because these runaways, like,
because nothing about this movie screams quality. Nothing about this movie makes you think that the filmmakers really gave two shits other than capitalizing upon some booming genres and making some money.
Well, that's what I was thinking, the appearance of Aldo Ray, who is like some longtime genre actor from the 50s, like in The Marrying Kind. He was accredited, like, bona fide, legit actor.
Yeah, and like many actors of his ilk, i.e. Cameron Mitchell, etc., he just became a B-movie stalwart near the end of his career and just appeared in one schlocky, shitty movie after another one.
Because seemingly he was parachuted into this to be some sort of detective investigator, and he just protects one of these runaway kids in this ranch and takes them under their wing and starts explaining a bunch of backstories. So he's Mr. Exposition, talking about a curse, talking about the demons of Los Feliz, California, or whatever this is, and mentoring this young child and really explaining all that there is in the backstory and giving this convoluted explanation of this curse that's befallen this town. So he had zero purpose to be there. The runaway kid had zero purpose to be there.
This house. You got, when was his name, Nick?
Yeah, the little kid who's actually Punky Brewster's sibling, of all things. Like, he's...
In real life?
Yes, in real life.
Well, his name is Mino Palouse.
Mino Palouse, yeah.
He's Salel Moon Fry, so what's...
Hey?
They have different last names.
Yeah, they're half-siblings. Okay. I Wikipedia'd this. Again, like, they contribute a big, giant, fat zero to this movie, and it divert attention away from the potential tension between the father... raising his daughter. Like, there's nothing there. That they do nothing. All they do is occupy time.
No, because now we have this de facto family. Because we got Nick, played by Mina Palouse. We got another runaway who's introduced as a cowboy.
Who looks about 28.
Captain America.
Yeah.
I forget. I guess that was his name, Cowboy.
Yeah.
And they're not living in this home under the auspices of Patty. But Patty is actually...
Petronella in disguise. Yeah, and again, it was just so... like hackneyed and convoluted, and like,
and don't forget that we were keeping flashbacks to the Stone Age and 12,000 years ago, and they were showing the exact same shit that happened in the beginning yet again.
Yeah, James Joyce was more straightforward. Like, I did not like. I watched this twice. Like, and
how could you?
Yeah, because in order to keep Petronella straight and keep all these developments straight, and. Ultimately, the runaways connect with the daughter, Bondi, and I'm not entirely sure how, but they manage to, God knows what, to allay the curse. I don't know how they did it. That's the extent of my understanding of this film.
Well, I'm glad you have an understanding of it, because I certainly didn't. For most of this film, I was bored to tears. Like I said before, there was lots of flashbacks. At one point, Bondi says, tell me a story of the city before there were people, and they're flashing back to yet again, showing the scenes of...
Yeah, and weird cutaways to jackals and foxes, and I don't know.
Yeah, and all I'm thinking is Bondi is bored hearing the story as I am watching it and seeing all the stock footage of animals and whatnot.
And one thing is quite intriguing, and I guess this might segue into what we learned, but there's some weird sexual dynamics, which was, I guess, par for the course at the time, where you have, again, the aforementioned amulet that the father is showering his daughter with love and attention and obsession. He gives her this gold amulet, and he communicates with her telepathically. Because in one scene, she's picked up, she's on the side of the road, and she's picked up by these young guys driving a van, who subsequently attempt to sexually assault her, and do sexually assault her. She calls Daddy, and the amulet glows red, and through some sort of weird telekinesis, the father causes the van to veer off the road explode.
That was hilarious.
And so the van explodes, and then you think that's the end of Bond. I want to say the beach always. Yeah. The Bondi.
That was hilarious.
It was hilarious.
The van literally fell
like about 10 feet.
10 feet and exploded into glorious.
It was like Hiroshima, that van. It's unbelievable.
And
then you thought, oh, how did they get dispatched with Bondi?
There's a cutaway in Bondi. Yeah, without a scratch. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the weird. And then when Bondi meets up with this young runaway played by Mino Palouse.
You know, I know Mino Palouse. Let me tell you, I know Mino Palouse.
Well, long time child actor.
Well, but yeah, back in the day, I mean, I can't even recall one credit he's in, and I'm surprised about the whole Salel Moon Fry.
Connection.
I like Punky Brewster. I watched him back in the day, both the cartoon and the live action show. And my sister, she bought all those teen magazines, and your 16s and your Teen Beats and your Bops and your Big Bops and your Little Bops and your whatever.
And your Bops.
And I remember that they would have, because he never reached any heights of your Ricky Throws, your Kirk Camerons, not even your Menudos, but there was little articles on this Mino Palouse kid. And I guess he was a budding teen idol. What else was he in? What other credits could I enjoy?
I couldn't tell you. I didn't delve too much into that. I thought it was enough that we got into Linnea Quigley and Aldo Ray, but yeah, just his introduction, very weird. He reaches down her blouse to try and steal the amulet, I believe, and it was just...
Oh yeah, when they first meet.
And she chastises him for being a little pervert, so there's weird perversion. Yeah,
exactly, and what was hilarious is when they first meet, she finds this farmhouse, she's sleeping, in walks Nick, Minopalouse, he's 16, he's 8, he's trying to cop a feel...
Yeah, and she's already been shown topless in a van. I mean, this is bizarre
stuff. She wakes up, chastises him, and says, "Listen, don't do that. At least wait until you're 12.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a good thing, you know.
Yeah,
don't be a skeezy perv until you're at least 12 years old. Come on.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, once you hit the advanced age of your preteen years, then, you know, all bets are off. Yeah, did he? Yeah.
There's a budding love story between Cowboy and
Bondi. The denouement, I fully don't understand. I think it's beyond the understanding of, well, probably you as well, and likely our listeners at this point too, if it's not getting a little too convoluted. Mm-hmm. What did you learn?
Well, I feel like you're always pushing me to the what did you learn too fast. I don't know what I want to say. Because ultimately...
We're learning a lot.
This is meant to be a horror movie. This has a title befitting... the horror movies of its ilk that came out around that time.
Yeah.
This was a video nasty. This is meant to be scary. And yet, it really, to me, the tone was so bizarre that with the, you know, here you go from this sort of like quasi-fancy sci-fi sort of weird opening, and then it really felt more like a coming-of-age sort of after-school special with this weird... witchery and...
Yeah, and odd sorcery and cannibalism. Yeah, travel, and it was just what?
Completely befuddling. And, you know, I really kind of, as I said to you before, I was vacillating with this movie. From confusion to anger to entertainment. Back to anger. Back to a little of entertainment. To boredom. I didn't know. I mean, this movie it ran for about an hour and 20 minutes.
I think... yeah.
And I was all over the map watching this thing.
I think, yeah, you were vacillating and my skin was vasodilating. Maybe, I don't know. Like, I got a pretty good impression. I felt like I needed smelling salts because I felt like at times the kind of woozy sensations that typically occur when we're watching, let's say, Cracker Jack 3 or something that's really, I mean... say what you will about Manos. Like, Manos is a straightforward narrative. You have people who get lost and get, for lack of a better word, terrorized by a creepy man in a house, for lack of a better word. Really, that's not the case, but it's totally straightforward. You're standard, you get lost. This thing, like, really defies description. And I, you know, frequently what happens when you have, like, a movie, like, Don't Go in the Basement or something, where we pointed out that the basement... features so unprominently in the film. That's why I thought in post they must have done something, because this park they keep speaking of is only shown once. So there's maybe a park where the fishing scene took place, where the garroting of the kid by Gar. There's no park. They don't hang out in a park.
Well, this is filmed where the shack is? Where
that's not even a park. It's like a ranch. It's in the middle of the desert. There's no park at all in the sense I understand it. Like...
Well, there's no playground, if that's what you're looking for.
No, just like a little spot of green where you go and there's trees. There's no park to speak of.
Okay.
There was a riverbed, there was a ranch in the desert. There's no park. So, Don't Go Near the Park is an admonition that shouldn't be too hard to follow, because there's no fucking park, for starters. A great line. You never give me gold, which is Linnea Quigley, like kitchen sink drama, like soap opera afternoon wailing after her daughter gets bestowed this wonderful gift,
and then she follows up by going, "I see what's going on here. She's gold and I'm copper."
Yeah,
copper's kind of valuable, isn't it? Copper wire.
Yeah, copper wire is frequently stolen off of job sites. So yeah, yeah.
There's nothing wrong being copper.
And this is a Sweet 16 party where none of the other teenagers take notice of the fact that the adults are warring with one another, and they just stand there and they don't speak. It was baffling, to say the least. So much to learn.
There was a scene where, very inexplicably, Petronella and or Patty grab some flowers. Oh, because they made mention that there was a flower that Nick Minopoulos sold to Aldo Ray that was highly...
Yes.
And there was a scene where Patty is grinding up and smoking it, so she's getting high. Inexplicable, I don't know why.
Well, that was the other thing I learned. There's a if there is one motif, it's a like a kind of peace pipe that comes with them from 12,000 years ago to present day, and there's a it looks like a like an Aboriginal peace pipe, and I don't know, is that the conduit to smoke this plant? Is this plant cultivated in the park we never see? Like I don't know, but there's a peace pipe that is smoked by Petronella and by the cavemen. What are they implying? Again, I'm peppering you with questions. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can handle it. You look exasperated. But are they trying to imply that this is all like a hallucination because of the visions from smoking this plant? Nah. Like, are they delusional, or are they actually, like, are they actual sorcerers? I'm not fully cognizant of the significance of this plant, why it was introduced, and why this Aldo Ray guy was going on about it. But again, if there's the demons of Los
Feliz... Why was Aldo Ray even in there?
Well, that's true, but and who are the demons of Los Feliz? Like, they're demons. This is a sorcery movie about cannibalism. Who are the demons, and what impact do they have? You're looking at me with squinted eyes and a furrowed brow. So, I'm pretty much lost.
I mean, it's funny because this is a movie that I watched, and I'm going to file it away as, okay, I saw it. Huh. It was absolutely, completely, just maddeningly obtuse. I don't ever want to revisit it again. And here you are watching it twice.
I'm dotting my I's and crossing my T's. I wanted to get to the bottom of this.
What else did you learn?
Oh, my God. Whew. Yeah, again, this mask business made no sense whatsoever unless, this is, again, conjectural. Are they immortal, these people? Yes. So presumably, they're wearing a Petronella.
They're eating human flesh.
They're immortal.
But they're also aging 1 year, 10 years from
now. 10 year, okay. So the mask is to hide the fact that they're aging so rapidly, or like I do not, my understanding of the mask is completely elusive. So what good was that mask?
I don't know, but there was a pretty cool scene where they...
Because this will fit into what I learned, okay. If you're telling me, then I'll have learned it.
There's a pretty cool scene where, once again, I don't think they had permits or anything, but there was a parade that was going through town.
Yeah, it was like a Day of the Dead.
There was like the Day of the
Dead. Mexican kind of...
Yeah, these people wearing these sort of like cardboard box animal heads on, and it was kind of creepy. And then you have Petronella walking through, unnoticed wearing this mask because of the strange goings-on. So there was that, but I mean... And another thing, too, about Petronella, she wore an eye patch. She was blind in one eye. Not explained.
No. She made up for it with her third eye, because she could see visions, so she actually had two. I think that has exhausted what I've learned.
Really? Because you said something was going to lead into something else.
No. I'm... Well, again, you solved the dilemma of the virgin. So, assuming that was the curse that was bestowed on them, that in order to alleviate it, they had to get a virgin and someone who was related to them, then
it had to be the spawn of Gar's loins.
Okay, all right. So, but not just a regular virgin. That didn't matter, or like, because they kept going on about virgins, and they kept going on about I don't know what. But why did Gar not age prematurely, and only Petronella did? I did learn that that when we're first introduced to Gar in the beginning, it looked like a bad SNL sketch with like Bill Hader. He has this crazy salt and pepper hairdo and really super square looking, and it looked like I just didn't know what to make of Gar, who also changes his name midway through, and they didn't say why. And Gar became maybe Mike. I want to say Mike. If I'm wrong, it doesn't matter. But that's another thing I learned. It was just he just transitioned. Why didn't Petronella?
It would have been more interesting if he transitioned.
It might have been. Yeah, exactly. Well, why didn't Petronella, was she of too an advanced age to, why didn't she give birth to a child as well and reverse engineer or reverse age herself by feeding on virgins and then give birth so they could have two spawned. Like, did it have to be from the fruit of his loins? Like, that's kind of sexist. I don't know.
I don't know.
What's the female equivalent of the fruit of her loins? I don't know. I don't even know what loins are, to be honest. But star rating.
Star rating.
Yeah.
Is that, can you even ask me that? Like,
yeah. Honestly, you're looking at me so quizzically.
Yeah, because I can't give this. One star would be too kind to this film.
You think so? You think it compares unfavorably to Manos?
I like Manos. Manos.
Okay,
me,
come
is
on. Where they're driving around the California desert, lost. And
it's amazing.
They're driving around and around and around.
You got that amazing soundtrack, that incidental lounge music. You got Torgo, you got the master.
You got the robe.
The robe with the hands. You got just the title alone.
The kid and her missing dog.
Oh my God.
You got the virgins dancing around, like sapphic goddesses around that maypole type thing.
Manos.
You got the terrible artwork.
A bountiful cornucopia of entertainment.
Well, I would say it's shorter.
That too, but see, that's the whole thing. Like, a lot of times, these barometers of terrible movies, you know, your Manos Hands of Fates, your Planet Nine from Outer Spaces, your Blood Feast, these are not bad movies.
Yeah.
These are great movies. They might be somewhat inept in certain departments, but they're fun, entertaining.
Well, I was thinking
movies.
About that too. Is at least, like, Blood Feast was chronologically sound and made sense for the most part. Sure, there's a lot of, like, weird, sort of, Egyptian lore mumbo-jumbo sort of haphazardly deposited therein, but it Herschel would have been granted the slack of having made a movie 15 years prior to this with maybe not the means and all that. This looked like it had a budget, somewhat. It was made, like, it wasn't like this was a nascent, budding exploitation genre that they were just mavericks trying to work in, although maybe he was if he was 19, but they didn't have that excuse. Like, this at times looks like a legitimate movie, and so that's what's really off-putting tonally as well, in that there's really no excuse to come up with something this convoluted.
I want you to go home,
rewatch this,
fire up your YouTube, and tell me the exact minute when this actually looks like a legitimate movie.
Well, I mean, like, they clearly went...
They started on film. Okay, there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they got, well, let's say a quasi-marquee name, if, you know, severely on the downswing of his career, which would be Aldo Ray, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know.
No. Again.
But this was made for more than, like, $5,000.
Okay, but again, what I'm saying to you is that, as far as I'm concerned, Manos is 3.5-4 stars.
Hmm.
Plan 9, the same. A lot of these movies that people say are some of the worst movies of all time, I think are commendable movies that actually deserve to be rated much higher and deserve to be watched, rewatched, analyzed, studied, held in high esteem. This deserves to be in the dung pile, and it deserves to be in this
disparaged
bowel
endlessly
of YouTube as you...
I have another question. I don't know. Like, as we're going to maybe extend the podcast just a little bit here. There's a scene where Cowboy is making acquaintances with Bondi, and he says, like, that his parents, I guess, or he implies that his parents were abusive to him, and he pulls open his shirt and says at one point, like, look what they did to me. I didn't see anything on his chest. But he clearly pulls up his shirt to show what they did to him. I didn't see it. The kid fishing. I did not see the fishing rod. I was looking very closely. I didn't see the reel. I didn't see, the kid was fishing because Gar asked, how's the fishing today? But I didn't see the pull.
This was not...
And I saw the river.
Remember, you're watching this on YouTube. This was not, you know, 1080p high def.
Oh, no, fair enough. But if someone's fishing, surely, like, a fishing pole is, like, 5 feet long. Surely you're going to see the pull. I did not see that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you were the one under the influence. But, yeah, I'm going to, you know, what's the reverse of the opposite of admonishing is compelling and, cajoling. So I'm going to ask our listeners, like, to please watch this film.
Or,
please watch Don't Go Near the Park.
And I'm imploring you not to.
No, it demands a viewing. If only, like, someone has to be able to make sense of this.
Mm-hmm. So
someone out there. A star rating, I'm going to, well, bewildering, baffling, like, gonzo storytelling. that defies description. I'm going to give it 2.5, and yeah, I'm asking you out there to check it out. It's available on YouTube, and you can probably get. It might be out on Blu-ray, I'm not sure. It's definitely on Amazon. Go watch it, and definitely go check out our site, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. And of course, new episodes of the podcast uploaded every Friday for your listening enjoyment, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.